All right, another one of our special on the road episodes of Maddie on the Road. Hello, Tony.
Hey, Maddie, on the road. What's up?
Boy, we blinked and it's suddenly summer again, and I'm back on the road in weird hotel rooms looking like some sort of accident victim.
Yeah, the lighting isn't great in there for you, but this is an audio podcast.
That's true. We don't video it for reasons. Well, for quite clear reasons, if you could see the screen that Tony's seeing of me right now, which is my nostril.
It's just like a Sergio Leone shot of your eyes.
I'm doing that to Tony now, just like my one left eye.
Okay.
Well, so I'm out and about filming for my new treasure hunting adventure season that'll be on this winter. So I'll be coming and going all summer again. Thank you.
Which you otherwise can't talk about.
I can't talk about them until the episodes they run promos for them. Right. And then I can talk about them.
Yeah. But, so you can't talk about them for the long time. So you're going to be basically coming on and saying, oh, I'm doing all these amazing. Oh, it's crazy. I'm so tired. You wouldn't believe it, but we're not going to know.
Well, you remember last summer I was talking about being kind of like having like the longest day ever and being just slap happy and like, I can't believe I survived it. You're like, what are you doing? And then you actually got to see the episode. That was the episode where I was in the cave.
So, oh my God.
Similar things are going on now. That's all I can say.
Folks, really, this is no joke. He's doing stuff right now. He can't tell you about it, but he's doing stuff right now that would freak you out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Freak you out, but you wouldn't do. Most of you.
Most of you. So yeah, glad to be here. Miles can't keep us apart, Tony. Last week we reviewed, and forgive me, I don't have my normal bells and whistles when I'm on the road, so we'll have to kind of do this bare bones. But last week we did The Deep House, a diving movie, which is quite appropriate for where I am now and what I'm doing. Hint, hint. And we kind of disagreed on it, although we both didn't pass it. I liked it a little bit more than Tony and fought for it a little bit, but in the end, we both didn't give it a P for paranormal. We gave it a P for pass for no thanks. We got what could be the message of the year indirectly through superfan Kerrig, but actually it's Kerrig's wife who had maybe the line of the year because he was conflicted. I think he liked The Deep House, Tony, and was really trying to understand what we're both saying about it. And so he kept messaging our Facebook account and saying, I got to watch it again. And I got to listen to your review again, cause I'm conflicted. And he goes, I showed my wife The Deep House. This is her summary, quote, it's paranormal, but shitty. She then went on to ramble about the screenplay, saying it would only have been about 6 pages long had they taken out every occurrence of the word Ben.
Well, she and I are in agreement there, apparently. That was a sticking point for me. Kerrig, I can't tell you how happy I am that you're into this show enough to disagree and watch something again and tell us about it. I love that so much. You know, I'm curious what you thought on the second viewing, if you ended up kind of feeling more like your wife did, or if you just disentrenched you further into supporting the movie like Maddie.
We might have a new tagline for this very show, rated P for paranormal. It's paranormal, but shitty.
A 100% agree with that. That's a t-shirt. Let's see if people want that t-shirt and then we'll make that.
And actually that might be the tagline for this week's film. Coming off the heels of The Deep House, we had mentioned diving, and our top three last week because of diving was underwater scenes. And I had mentioned Splash as one of my choices. And then we just said, let's review Splash because we haven't done like that type of cryptid, like underwater cryptid, mermaids, things like that. So that's what we're doing this week, Splash. And our top three this week, actually, Tony, inspired by Splash, will be what at the end of this episode?
Let me look at my notes here.
Yes.
What did we say it was? Top three inhuman love affairs. What was that? Was that it?
Yes.
Inhuman love.
Yes. Like, cross human, cross species love.
Yeah. Yeah.
When humans go wrong.
This sounds like an after hour show. It really isn't.
It's not, trust me, it'll be fine. But and then I just want to tease this coming up. Next week, we will be reviewing the latest season, I believe season 4 of Stranger Things, which I actually dove into on my plane rides to where I am, Tony, for this trip. And I'm excited to talk about Stranger Things season 4. I'm not going to say good or bad, but I'm excited to talk about it. I don't know if you've been able to watch any of it yet. But
No, because I don't really trust that we're going to be doing it. When you say next week, I have to say that you should say next episode, probably.
It's a great point.
Because I don't know if that's going to happen in a week. I'm ready. And am I excited? I don't think I'm excited. I think that I'm curious to see where this goes. I'm very curious. I don't know that. I feel like we're doing our due diligence. So I feel good about it. I feel positive, excited. I don't know if I am.
Understood. Yes, you feel like it's the right thing for us to do as a show, but you might not be personally excited to see the season.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's fair. And you're right. The parlance here is important. The words are important.
It's all we got.
Next episode, if I'm not in a shark tank somewhere underwater or something, or in the Sahara Desert being dangled in front of scorpions or running among snakes in the Texas wilderness, then we will be reviewing Stranger Things, the new season.
Can I ask you a question, though?
Yeah.
Seriously. We need to get a producer here to help us, because... Where are the audio clips to me from these places? Could you at least get your iPhone out when you're underwater in a shark tank and make a voice recording for the show?
I have other things on my mind in these moments, Tony.
Shame on you. At least you have the courage to publicly admit it.
I think I did actually play for you, though, in my defense. And this is one of the great gags of my life, given the circumstances. I was 200 feet underground in that cave system. And basically... cave above me and cave below me, where all you could do is crawl on your belly for about 15 feet, 200 feet underground. And your head's banging the top of the cave above you. Thank God you have a helmet on. And I started doing, and I filmed myself doing, and I believe I sent this to you, a parody of Bruce Willis in Die Hard going, "Come to the coast," they said. And so I started going, "Host a show," they said.
Yes, it was brilliant. And you did. I take it back. You did that. And I'm just being hostile for no reason.
Well, you're right. More to come. I'll be better about that for you.
Yeah. As I said, you're the working man's Travis Taylor. It's true.
Tony, what we're going to do now is we're going to set up a laser.
Say laser again. Say laser again. I dare you.
All right. Let's get into Splash. This, of course, is an 80s iconic classic. Tom Hanks and company. And of course, we know the plot. Basically, a mermaid that he meets as a child. They reunite in the adult world in Manhattan and fall in love. He doesn't know she's a mermaid until a climactic part in the movie. Spoiler alert, he finds out and all hell breaks loose because Eugene Levy is a scientist trying to prove that she exists. Which, before we get to the movie, Tony, I wanted to broach that with you. Today, I had a little bit of time, a little downtime, and I just did a Google search for real mermaids is what I Googled. And the mythology and actual stories of people who believe they saw mermaids is quite compelling and goes back to Columbus, and many kind of old maritime people, sailors, things like that, that swore them and their crew that they saw these swimming creatures. And, you know, we never laugh anything off in this show in terms of that, in terms of what people believe they saw, but it maybe has particular resonance now with all the USO activity going on, things underwater. I mean, who are we with things flying out of the water now in modern day to besmirch the ancient sailors who spent their lives out on the sea saying they saw these creatures, right?
Yeah, you make a really good point. The Pentagon admitted that things are flying in and out of the ocean. It's not me. You didn't hear it from me. So nice. So if that's happening to me, all bets are off. Okay. Mermaids is not a hard step for me to take after that.
Right. There's even some pictures and video that exist. One of the videos in particular that's popular to me is a total setup and faked. but a couple are kind of blurry enough. They're kind of Bigfooty enough that you think, well, there could be something to that. Maybe it's another type of creature. The person stick for a mermaid. But the kind of mystery of it, the allure of it is definitely appealing. I love mermaids as a cryptid. I never think to answer that when I've been on a couple of paranormal podcasts over the years. They always ask me my favorite cryptid. And I always say Bigfoot's the granddaddy of them all. And I had an experience with the Bigfoot in the woods, but I might say mermaid is my favorite to kind of think about, you know, this kind of, and the allure of it. Although the Columbus sighting, Christopher Columbus and his men who believe they saw these creatures said in his diary, basically from what I read in the Google search today, he basically said, and his men attested that these things are not beautiful. All that stuff you're hearing is basically bullshit about these beautiful women. They look like kind of ugly sea men, you know, creatured men with these kind of flat faces, and the hair is not beautiful. And but they are swimming half fish, half humans. And they, so who knows what the hell they saw, but it's kind of compelling to read that.
It's not the weirdest thing I've heard of that turned out to be true.
It's well said. Yeah.
I mean, it's not. So I think it would be, I mean, look, if you, and I don't want to get into a Bigfoot thing here on the show, cause I'm not as well versed in it as you are. I'm completely respectful of it, but I don't have any feeling about that. I've never seen anything, except for the Patterson-Gimlin film that made me go, wow, okay. Like everything else has been just so, I don't know.
Right.
Did you make that footprint? Could you? Sure.
Right.
But this is easier for me to believe, like as an evolutionary step that we're not seeing them a lot if they live in the ocean. There's so many things that live in the ocean. We're finding new things all the time.
Yeah.
Stuff from the deep is coming up like in nets that they're like, what the hell is that? All the time. So I could see it, I guess.
And yeah, we do. We find new creatures, and they say that old thing. They say that we know more about space and you know than we do about the deep forest, even,
right.
and especially the ocean. The ocean is so vast. I mean, most of the world is water, so it makes sense. Maybe there is some sort of, if you don't want to do the, if you can't make, if that's a bridge too far for you, that there's a half person, half fish out there in the deep. Then maybe there is some sort of creature. These creatures do look strange, with some sort of flat human looking face that we haven't identified yet, that can, you know, jump like a dolphin. And we just don't know what it is yet. And that's what people were seeing.
Sure. Or go ask John Keel what he thinks. You know, I'm sure there's like, you know.
Incredible you said that, because when I was thinking about it, I made a note to myself to say, but if you read your Keel and you know that, you know, the paranormal world, whatever it is, whatever these things are, these entities are, if you are thinking mermaid, they'll manifest some sort of swimming creature to mess with you.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, just to put a little perspective on this, and it's interesting that Keel comes up with us.
Yeah.
Because I was watching, you know, as you know, I'm like, I've been just kind of being a nut and binging a lot of Secrets of Skinwalker Ranch. It's my new, you know, passion show right now. It's also kind of like doing it for some research on a thing I'm kind of working on. So,
oh, nice. Okay.
I
can put you in touch with the producers, by the way, if you need to.
Yeah. So I was listening to an interview with that George Knapp was giving with Travis Taylor.
Yep.
Dr. Travis Taylor, who is the astrophysicist and multi-doctorate science official on Skinwalker Ranch, the show, and down there for real, researching stuff. And this guy started out total skeptic, and like 6 months later walked off that ranch just being like, nope, something's up, and we're going to try to figure out what it is. Don't know what it is, but something's going on.
Yes.
He made a reference, I think, to how well read you are, or George Knapp did, on that interview. And they brought up John Keel as like a indicator of whether you know what you're talking about when you talk about this stuff. And the fact that his name in particular is coming up at all is probably the scariest thing that I've heard all year, and it's been a scary year.
Agreed. Yeah.
So anyway, there you are. I think you know, who knows, maybe it's actual fish creatures that evolution, like, you know, hid from us and in under the waves. And maybe it's an elfin lady in like his time loop.
Now, who knows? I'm going to blow you away even more now and just tell you, because I don't give anything away about the shows, you know, but I can say this, what I'm doing involves ocean and deep ocean and seas. So I'll be out on the seas for the next 4 days straight.
That's fantastic.
And we're having this conversation. I mean, that's just insane. We did not plan that. So even though I knew this trip was coming, so maybe psychosomatically you could say I suggested Splash, but I don't think so. And I'm definitely going to see a mermaid now. Awesome. Great. Well, whatever I see can't equal one of the earliest shots of this movie, Splash, which really kind of was a fun watch for me. But I've got, it's a complex review because this movie challenges me in a lot of ways. And also there's a lot to like such as the first shot of Daryl Hannah peering over the rocks when Tom Hanks is first kind of stranded on the Cape Cod and he sees her for the first time. You know, I was thinking, I wrote down in my notes, we see Bo Derek and Phoebe Cates all the time, these iconic woman shots. I think we should see Daryl Hannah peeking over those rocks and less of Bo Derek and less of Phoebe Cates, because I mean, she almost looks inhuman, ironically, yeah, because she's a mermaid, but has there ever been a more stunning creature than her peering over those rocks in that moment?
She's extremely lovely. I just want to point out that you're using references that are from like Laugh In from 1971. You're talking about things that I don't know that we can even justify talking about. You're talking about Bo Derek running on a beach. Does anybody even know?
Oh my God.
Who knows when what a podcast is? Are they listening to that?
Wait a second. Hold on. I understand it's not Fellini, but if you're going to do like iconic female water-based scenes.
You just said, I keep seeing it.
Like, no. Where? Yeah, like in a top 10. Like, okay, so if it's you go true. Water yeah. women, you're going to see Bo Derek running the beach and you're going to see Phoebe Cates coming out of the pool over and over and over again.
However, I'm saying that maybe like Pamela Anderson would be something that is more, not even any more up to date, but more up to date than Bo Derek. That's all I'm saying.
But she doesn't have an iconic film scene that they would show.
I beg to differ.
Well, I guess it depends on what kind of film you mean. I just think that scene's underrated is my long-winded way of saying by using those other examples.
I agree. Okay. Yeah, I agree.
Film moment is her appearing all those rocks. What a shot that is. I mean, I would say it didn't age well in a lot of ways. In some ways it did. I mean, there's laughs here. I laughed a lot. I cringed a lot. I laughed a lot and I cringed a lot.
Did you cringe at what were you cringing at?
Okay.
The juvenile humor?
Yeah, some of the humor really doesn't work. Some of it has not aged well. John Candy's character is a bit of a challenge for a modern audience, maybe. Even though I love him, I almost wanted to do top three John Candy moments as our top three, and I love him so much. So this is nothing to do against him. It's just the character. I think some of Tom Hanks' happiness and cheerfulness comes off a little bit like Abbott and Costello when we were saying, boy, he works awful hard and he's awful happy with himself doing those scenes. And there was a couple cringy moments with Tom Hanks kind of being Tom Hanks-y, if that makes sense. And the Eugene Levy character and the characters around him. It's funny, Eugene Levy's character is always screaming until basically the final time you see him. He's just screaming constantly at these two guys he's hired, these hired hands, who actually reminded me of the ancillary characters who didn't work in Bubba Hotep from 2 weeks ago. We said some of those actors didn't really work. Same type of, you know what I mean? So, you know, there's a lot that kind of doesn't work in the movie, which we'll get into. But there's a lot that does, too. I mean, I laughed out loud the line when Tom Hanks is in a boat with the guy and the guy that little, he has a little boat and he calls him Fat Tony, I think. And he says, or Fat.
No, Fat Jack, Mr. Fat
Jack.
Fat Tony. Thank you. I wonder why you said that.
Hey, man. I'm
wonder
sorry.
Why you said that. It's just out of nowhere.
I don't want to bring up past traumas. And he just says, you know, I'll fix it. I'm mechanical. And he starts banging on it with a hammer. And then he goes, I'll be back. I'm going to go with the little boat. I mean, that stuff's funny. If you don't laugh at that, you know, you're dead.
What was, before we just get into you just spewing kind of gray distaste at this movie, what is your relationship to this film? It came out in 1984. Did you see it when it came out? Did you have any affection for it? Did it not have enough sports in it for you?
I remember I used to do an impression for my friend. So I must have seen it in high school. I did it. I used to do an impression when a pretty girl walked down the hall or something. I would go, and she stood as a symbol of liberty and justice for all, but she bowled.
So, okay. I this is another like nostalgia thing for me, this movie, big time.
I get it.
Big time. This was one of these movies where I haven't seen it in years. Like, it's honestly been at least 10 years since I've seen it, maybe longer. I don't even remember the last time I saw it, but I saw it so much on cable when it was out, you know, when it came out in 84, or when it came on cable in 85, I guess, that I'd memorized. I literally had it memorized. So in watching it this time, I knew every single line of dialogue.
Wow.
Not like I couldn't write it down, but as it was happening, I could recite the line with the actor, you know.
Oh, that's fun.
And I don't know what it was exactly that really got to me about this movie, except in kind of looking at that year of 1984 and like the movies of 1984, you can kind of see, because like other fantasy movies, this was an interesting combination of kind of like Saturday Night Live and you know, SCTV, literally, humor, and really smart, dumb comedy writing. Like, the two writers, Babalu and Lowell Gans, it's Lowell Gans, right? And Babalu Mandel. They really, to me, had a great ear for ridiculous comedy. Like, I just, those guys' writing makes me laugh. And when I'm looking at the other stuff that was out there, this was such a unique kind of movie. We had The Never-Ending Story was one of the other, you know, fantasy outings. Nightmare on Elm Street came out, but that's a completely different thing. Firestarter is a completely different thing. And I think there was something really, to me, really hip about this movie at the time, in the writing and in the casting of it, and in the knowing quality that it has about what it is. Because it knows it's kind of a medium, low budget, jokey, ridiculous movie that was sold based on a stupid idea.
Right.
And then they hired the cheapest people they could at the time, including Ron Howard, who had not, I mean, he had Night Shift, I guess, was before, right before this, which was a hit, but he was untested.
Right. He wasn't the iconic name that he is now, other than his acting career, more than his directing career, probably.
And it was just so kind of different, you know, it really stood apart to me. See him in an interesting way, kind of an interesting companion to Ghostbusters, which also came out.
Yeah, I thought of Ghostbusters a lot. It's very New York-y.
And the same kind of like improv comedians in the movie kind of humor, you know, and writers. So I don't know. I have a really warm feeling about it. And I think it really kind of inspired me as a writer. I just thought some of the lines are just, to me, drop on the floor funny. I just can't. I even this last watch, I was just like, you're killing me. This is so stupid. It's so stupid. But I gotta love a movie that knows it's stupid and does it anyway. And this is one of those movies for me. So
yes, I agree with everything you're saying. I don't want to come off like this is going to be a slam by me. I'm just saying I was both ways, you know, I was kind of torn both ways. The things that don't work kind of jumped out at me, because I, again, haven't seen it since I was probably that age, when I was a sophomore in high school doing that line, and until now. So I think, but yeah, I mean, there's lines like, you know, and you know it's coming.
Oh, yeah.
He looks at her and he goes, she doesn't speak any English at all. She goes, hello, Alan, how is your day? It's like, if you don't laugh at that, if you don't think that's funny, like, you know, like
I There are slapstick gags in it that make me laugh. Yep. We watched one of them on a repeat like 10 times in a row last night. We just went back and rewound one of these gags 10 times.
May I ask?
The spoon in the fancy restaurant.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
He's drumming on the table nervously, like, you know, and then he hits the end of the spoon and it accidentally flies across the room and hits a guy, like an old guy on a date. Editing on that time, the timing and editing on these gags, it's simple, but it just like hits a funny, it's like a knee jerk reaction for me. I just can't help myself.
Yes.
And then for me, when the movie admittedly does get just a little dated or a little bit, just a lick too much, I can't argue that point with you, but my feeling about it, maybe that's just because I have this warm nostalgia for it, is that I kind of forgive it because I feel like it knows that about itself. And it's like, it kind of becomes on purpose in a weird way. And we'll get to that in a second, because there's something about it that I want to talk about, like, seriously.
Yeah.
Because it's not a very serious movie. It really isn't. Right. Except for one or two things, which for me make me want to really fight with you about maybe the worth of it. But
well, I have something too. I dug a little deeper myself, so I'm looking forward to hearing this, what I think this movie might have been saying.
Now, honestly, you know, I had a pretty big crush on Daryl Hannah at the time. I think I'm not alone. I think probably half of the world, or all of the world, had a crush on Daryl Hannah at that time.
My God.
I think that, like, as she really brings something to this part, I really think that she is, this could be so easily distasteful in that regard, you know, and the kind of off color humor, it's okay, it hasn't aged particularly well through today's lens. I'm happy to go back in time sometimes and just kind of see it for where it was at that time.
Sure.
Candy has enough pathos in him so that you understand why he's got these problems. And I felt like that was at least addressed, you know, in the movie.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I think is kind of crazy amazing about it is that I'm not the person to ask necessarily, but I don't get a very weird, lechy male gaze to the extreme about Daryl Hannah in this movie that I think other films would have about her, that, like the ones you've mentioned, like 10 or, you know, Tarzan with Bo Derek, like they were all just about her being naked in this movie.
Right. Yes.
And Daryl Hannah, they really honored her with some smart character stuff, some actually funny stuff. And I feel like she's in on it. At least as a performer, I don't know how she felt about, you know, the scantily clad part of it, but I feel like they made her into a character that wasn't just about being, you know, this kind of like blonde, you know, ideal mermaid lady.
In fact, to highlight that point, and one of the things I really like about it is that because the first half of this movie really is about a guy's fantasy of this magical, gorgeous, stunning creature that comes out and just it comes into your life and just starts making out with you. And I mean that figuratively and literally in this case.
Right.
You don't need to know her name. She's just there to serve you and make out with you. And she's more stunning than any girl you've ever dreamed of being with. It's like, it's a guy's fantasy, but it doesn't stop there. And it goes a little deeper. Mm-hmm. And this is getting into, I want to hear yours first, but this,
okay,
this fins nicely into the point I wanted to make about what I think it's saying. But I want to hear yours first, and then I'll kind of share my thoughts on what this movie's saying.
Well, just when you think that the movie is gone off the rails into a cartoonish kind of almost too childish like level of humor, because as much as I love Eugene Levy, there's a couple of times where he's trying to throw water on somebody and take a picture of them when they turn into a mermaid, where I'm just like, this is like a From a Thomas the Train. Like, what am I, what's happening here?
Three Stooges.
Was an adult anywhere near this movie set for 5 seconds?
Right.
But what's interesting is that in the middle of the most like egregious part of that plot area, like when the, you know, the plot kind of kicks in, right? The government kind of gets involved in maybe kidnapping her or whatever. When Tom Hanks realizes she's a mermaid, when he sees her in her true form, his reaction is so perfectly realistically disturbed and upset and freaked out. He doesn't want to be near her, like for real. Like, he literally cringes when she comes near him. And the fact that they went to that level of honesty about his character and how hard this was going to be for emotionally for a minute, I couldn't believe it. I'd forgotten that part of the movie and was like, because he's not faking it. He's not, it's not like a jokey kind of like, oh my God, you're a mermaid. That's weird. He's literally like in a horror movie, trapped in a tank with something he doesn't want to be near. And I that was like, I didn't remember that. That I thought deep in this movie in a way I was not expecting.
Last week, I talked about Tom Cruise's power of being a charismatic action star. And this week I saw Tom Hanks's power of being the type of movie star he is. And that is that he can be this lovable, adorable, funny, alluring guy, and then turn into Jimmy Stewart in the next scene and give a powerhouse performance. Him in the tank, him in the tank that you just mentioned. If I do give it a P for Paranormal, which I'm going to do a better job of hiding my vote. If I do give it that, it's that scene that saves it. And to your point, this is exactly the scene that I was going to share and say, this movie goes one step deeper. Because as I mentioned, it does seem to be a fantasist guy. We see her naked here and there, and she's just making out with him and serving him. But then when he sprays her with water, and Tom Hanks sees who she really is, I wrote this, boy, effective metaphor for his lack of commitment. And maybe all of us, when we find things out about our loved ones, maybe things we aren't so happy to find out. She says to him, whatever my secret was, you said you'd understand. And then I talk about his performance in the tank, which is an incredible bit of acting by him. So, boy, isn't that a great moment for all of us? Like when we find out things about the one we love that doesn't fit our narrative of them, how much do you really love them? It almost reminds me of what Dante did Carrie in Carrie, when we talked about the tracking shot and the kind of, you think it's a fantasist piece.
Yeah, exactly. Similar idea.
You want to really know a woman? Here you go. Yeah. And I think this movie is a powerful metaphor for that.
And in a way, I mean, this movie is an incredibly gentle, sweet, goofy, ridiculous, fluffy comedy. But that moment packs the same punch that it had in Carrie because the cognitive dissonance of it is amazing. Because it literally does get really serious in that tank. It gets uncomfortably serious. And she is so wounded by his reaction. She breaks your heart. I mean, it's really like tragic. I was surprised at that. And I wrestled a lot with how I was going to come down on this
movie. Yeah.
Here's my feeling. Let me just finish. Was, you know, my nostalgia makes me want to just like carry it over the finish line in and of itself. But I have to really look at the movie and assess what it is to me today and stuff. So I was wrestling with this, but I came up with that, and I'm like, wow, how rare is it that a movie, really even any, let alone a fluffy movie, but like any movie, gives you that level of our hero main character is going to do something that's just wrong. He's going to abandon her when she absolutely needs him the most, and he leaves her. Based on his own, you see it happen.
Yeah.
And you totally get why at that point, you know, John Candy's character is in there, why he is this kind of like disgusting semi-pervert character, you know, with a lot of like sexual hangups and stuff. And I mean, it's funny and it's played for gags, but there's something distasteful about it. But he knows that there's something wrong with himself about it. And the movie kind of keeps sucker punching you with these little truths, you know, and I had to really respect that. The other thing about it that I thought is unique, is particularly for the time, is that this is a really early example. This movie is kind of making fun of this kind of movie as these kinds of movies were happening.
Mm-mm.
And by that, I mean, there's a whole section where the government kidnaps her, right? And we've seen that like referenced in Spielberg movies and stuff, but it was all like an 80s kind of thing where the bad government guys would come and get Matthew Broderick and take him somewhere, or they would get, you know, E.T. and take him somewhere, or the government was always had these secret organizations that were going to come in, and they for no money, create the biggest satire on that concept for the in this movie that to me, even when the movie starts kind of falling apart, it's almost funnier because it isn't that because it's so slapdash. And that was kind of like to me a bit ahead of time, like to be making fun of those tropes, you know, in 84. Pretty great.
Yeah, the troops running almost become a Monty Python sketch with hook, 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 hook. Yeah, it's just, it becomes, and that's probably the influence of those writers, or it is the influence of those writers. And also you have the spirit of Eugene Levy and a John Candy, the SCTV spirit, which is closely tied to Monty Python, obviously. So
absolutely, and to other great 30s and 40s screwball comedies, people like Preston Sturges or like Howard Hawks movies like Bringing Up Baby, there's a real screwball quality to this movie, as opposed to, you know, I don't know what we were getting as comedies mostly at the time, which was we were coming out of like all the high school comedies. John Hughes ruled it. And I just wasn't a John Hughes guy. I hated high school. I didn't want to see movies about high school because I freaking hated it. So why did I want to see movies about it? And I think there were a lot of us like that. This was a perfect antidote. And it was, you know, the DNA goes back to these really funny 30s screwball comedies. And I say that because the writing is on point like that. The jokes are that kind of like ridiculous and well-timed. And so anyway, those are my thoughts about it.
Now I'm trying to think if there's anything paranormal in the Sure Thing so I can make you go watch it. I agree. Even Eugene Levy in that, after the Tom Hanks tank scene, comes back down to earth and gives a really nice little performance.
Care about him.
In the tank. Yes. So, I mean, there's things that were frustrating a little bit here and there, but I agree with you. Like that's when it really kind of turned for me. And then even you're right. Like the John Candy stuff, and you know me, like I am the last.
That's why I was surprised to hear you being all pearl clutchy about his character.
Yeah, no, I'm the last person to be like, I hate the whole thing, which we've been in before. We've talked about before this whole thing. But that being said, it like that's kind of next level what he was portraying as a child. And but then he does at the end, he says something like, now, so in a badly executed version of this movie, that would never be addressed. And he would just be comic relief through the whole thing and just keep doing that and bumble around and do what he did for most of it. But there is that scene with him and Tom Hanks where he confronts him and he says, you know, Tom Hanks keeps saying things like, there's something wrong here, points to his heart. And John Candy basically calls him out at the end and says, there's nothing wrong with you. I can never be happy. He says, I'll never be happy, which is incredible because that whole movie is him being maniacally happy and joyful. Right.
You thinking that he's being presented kind of as this, you know, this goofy character that you're supposed to kind of want to be like,
this is how to be with the lady.
But that's not really what's going on. So,
yes.
I mean, I think when you really look at it, and also like seeing that what we're dancing around is that as a kid, we see him in a flashback in an early section of the movie, just for a minute, as like a 12-year-old throwing change on the ground and picking it up in order to look up girls' skirts. That's like his move. That's his thing.
Right.
And then you cut to, you know, whatever, 15, 20 years later, and he's doing the exact same thing as an adult, like at a wedding.
At a wedding, to the wedding guest. Yeah.
And it's ridiculously not what you can do today. It's like not on the menu, right? That behavior is not even supposed to be laughed at, I guess, today. But I feel like showing it that he had this problem as a kid and then showing it again later is actually not asking for puerile laughs. It's actually showing that he's got an issue. Mm-hmm. He's got a problem, and the film seems to recognize that, and it doesn't seem to be asking us to think he's, you know, a cool guy. I would imagine going back to see a movie like Stripes would probably make us feel a lot weirder.
Yeah, because you never have that scene. You never have the scene where he admits, "I'm never going to be happy. Right. I know I'm sick.
There may be something a little bit wrong with me because I behave this way.
Yes. Yeah, there's a couple other things that just didn't work. Maybe is a couple of the plot devices. I guess in a sense it doesn't matter when it's kind of a screwball comedy, but you know these things are there. So how Eugene Levy discovers her from one of those guys he hired who are not strong in this movie. They're reading a newspaper, and she's on the cover of that. And then there was another plot device with him, which you mentioned earlier, that had to do with the president speaking at a dinner, which was just clearly a setup so that he would have what looked like a weapon. It was like written around him having something in his coat that would look like a weapon. And it's just like that stuff.
I can't defend it other than to say it is so stupid that it almost comes around to be smart again.
That's the thing is that, and that very much could be the case and probably is given the other stuff we've said about where it ends up. It probably is this. There was a good Dubois in this movie.
Yeah.
When the lead scientist says to Eugene Levy, "I never took you seriously as a scientist. Why don't you go see if you can find a unicorn?" I'm like, he just fucking found a mermaid.
I know. But you're stuck wondering, like, was that just lazy writing, or was that actually kind of like commenting on the kind of cruel nature of that business of scientific research, where it's like they simply don't believe anything unless they have it in their tank and they're about to kill it.
Right. Yeah.
Outside of that, you're just an idiot to bring it up. So I thought maybe that's could have been smart, but it's hard to tell because these writers, you know, Lowell Gans and Bob Lou Mandel were really brilliant at, I mean, they come from Laverne and Shirley and Happy Days and stuff. They are masters of the stupidest brilliant stuff. Stupid brilliance. Like, it's just that's their thing.
My guess is in their goal to make that character hateable, they added that dialogue without really thinking of the ramifications of the fact that, well, he just but
my guess is, my hope is that there were nights where they were sitting together writing the script and they were smoking up and they were high or they were drinking a lot of beers and they were like, you know, we should probably bear down on this part of the plot because it's kind of ridiculous that he just, I mean, sees it in a paper. Let's make it better. I could just see them going, nah, don't want to do the work.
I hope that's true, actually, too. I hope that's true. Also, you know, again, nitpicky Maddie here, but underneath the East River ain't going to look like an Aruba snorkeling trip.
That's incredible, isn't it? It immediately cuts to Beach Boys video. It's insane.
And it's, you know, because there'd be no, like, oh, look, there's some coral reefs and some syringes.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, honestly, that would have been a great thing if the fight had happened in, like, with dead bodies and skeletons and garbage and barrels of waste just as the backdrop.
Totally. The ending too, which I won't spoil just in case no one's seen it. There is a line of dialogue, which I thought was kind of maybe purposely ironic, although probably not. She's explaining to him the rules that if you ever come with me, you can't come back. And he says to her, like, boy, that's, you know, I don't think I can come with you because I'd never see my family again. And she goes, I understand. And I just thought, we don't.
What? You're John Candy? You'll never see John Candy again.
Yeah. What are the rules here? He can survive because he's with you. So it's, you know, but again, to your point though, Tony, you make a great point. It's like at a certain point, who cares? It's Splash. It's about a mermaid and a dude, you know what I mean?
Because
those other things, they get away with it, I think.
I think you're right. I mean, I you could look at it this way, you know, in order for us to suspend the disbelief enough to even follow this story about a mermaid in the modern age who comes to New York City, you kind of can't make anything else that real because then you'd be like, then you'd constantly question the reality of the main situation. And I think in a way, everything has to be very cartoonish, broad, silly for us to go on that trip with any sense of, you know, caring whether they actually end up, which you do. I mean, that's the amazing thing about the movie is that it's actually fairly touching, you know, albeit sophomoric romance, you know, and
absolutely
it's really a rom-com, you know, with the added bonus of having this ridiculous cast and you know, and a fantasy, like, fantasy background. In this weird way, the stuff I was thinking about, like, God, if it had been better, tighter, smarter, more plot elements, I don't know if you would have then believed in or cared about any of the stuff that they were trying to say.
Because then your subconscious is going, oh, please, they're trying to pull this. Yeah. You know, there's another thing this movie never gets credit for, to my knowledge, and I don't know if this is even a thing, but at one point she's trying to think of a name. They're trying to think of a name for her. Mm-hmm. And she says Madison. He goes, that's not a name. Might as well, right. Maybe a good thing we didn't, maybe a 115th Street or whatever.
Yeah, it's a good thing we were on 179th Street.
And I thought to myself, you know, in 1984, he was right.
Yeah, it wasn't.
If there's 100 girls in your 50 mile radius, 90 of them are named Madison.
90 right of now. Them are named Madison. Yeah, it's true. Apparently, from what I read, it started the craze of the name Madison.
So that is actually a thing.
This was a really popular movie, and I think,
Wow, that's incredible. So it gets credit for that. And, you know, Tom Hanks, again, one of my lists didn't work. He does get New York-y also. He does little touches of being,
who's that?
Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, at times he throws in this kind of like little bit of, I'm a working man in New York, but doesn't fully commit to it. So it's only little touches here and there. And those are a little rough for me. But again, what he did in The Tank makes up for anything else that he does in the movie.
Let's see why I didn't see. I went a different direction with that. I assumed that probably because they summered in Cape Cod, that his family had money. And so he wasn't a working class New York guy. He was a rich college kid who ended up with a family business and was trying to be a tough New York guy in those moments.
Yeah. Either way, painful.
All right.
Like, all it right. Was, so it's a great character choice and painful, or it was him just trying to, you know, be New York funny with John Candy, his brother, painful, but yeah. It's nitpicky.
Yeah. How can you not just fall completely for a movie that pans with her as she's walking down the street and suddenly has a mug of pencils? I mean,
where did you get that?
Where did you get that? And I was like, sorry, sir. Excuse me. I'm so sorry.
Hilarious.
So yeah. It's just filled with moments like that kill me.
And it's funny. It's uneven in terms of those kind of ancillary little character actors. Some of them are so broad that they don't work, but then other ones are like really nuanced and wonderful, like the scene right before that in the TV shop. Those two actors are incredible in that scene.
Well, I would argue all day and night with you whether a lot of these performances, I think there's only a couple of beats that don't really work on that level, but since I think they're striving for Abbott and Costello level stuff here for the most part,
right?
To me, the bigger the better. Like those characters, like, you know, like the doctor, like Richard B. Schuell as Dr. Ross, the bigger they are, the funnier. It's like, it's literally like from a Laurel and Hardy movie for me. I love that part of it. I love the character actors in it. It's just freaking shameless. And yeah. So it's like, I think, you know, some of it's just not going to land particularly, but I wish we had seen this one together, particularly to see which gags we laughed at, if we were laughing at the same things or not, because I checked out for some of it too. Some of it's just not very funny.
Right. Right.
But there's gold in it though.
You're right.
The comedy is gold.
It's awesome. And that line made me laugh the hardest, that old kind of vaudevillian, like, trust me, she can't speak any English. Hello, Alan. How's your day? I just burst out laughing. And, you know, he does some physical stuff here. It's great. Tom Hanks, he falls to the bar. Oh, this is something I want to say, too. Boy, I wonder if they were thinking or if it was ever a discussion. But Tom Hanks and John Candy as a comedy duo could have worked. I could see them doing 5 movies together.
They did a few movies together. Well, they did Volunteers. I know that. Oh, yes,
right.
I think they tried to pair them up more, maybe, than that, because it was a great combo. The two of them together is great. But who, I mean, Candy makes everybody look good.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. He doesn't
the Candy Man. Like, who cares? I mean, come on. Yeah. What a treat to see him, no matter what's going on in that script for you. like the level of comedy here. Is he still, because you're a funny guy. By that I mean you're in the comedy world. Is he still considered like one of the all-time greatest things that ever happened?
Well, among the people I respect, yes. I don't think the new generation would particularly know his work. But, you know, I always hold up, and I'm sorry, it's a John Hughes film, but like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Oh, my God.
His performance in that is just incredible. I mean, talk about pathos.
And, oh, my God.
So, yeah, he's just the best. Although it was a bit of difficult foreshadowing to watch him complain about his heart in the racquetball scene when that's exactly how he went, you know.
Not when you know the story behind it.
How so?
He was actually so hungover that he was late for work that day because he went out drinking with Jack Nicholson the night before.
Yikes.
So Nicholson is the reason why he looks like that in that scene. And he felt as bad as he looked. Like he didn't feel good. The first thing they shot was him hitting his own head with the racquetball when he serves. And that was the first take. And that really happened. Yeah. He'd been drinking with Nicholson who was like, oh, you're shooting tomorrow. Huh? Okay.
Wow.
Oh, well, let's see if you're going to be shooting tomorrow. Yeah. God knows why they were in a bar together, but there you go.
There's one bar I would like to be in. All right. So Tony, at the end of the day, Splash, does it get written? Now, let me say this real quick. Carrick Taylor also said that in rewatching the movie from last week, he said, could you kind of just go over again? Because we do have a lot of new listeners, how we rate a movie. So let me just say, we're giving it a P for paranormal or a P for pass, meaning don't watch it. And I think this is correct, Tony. We kind of combine our opinion of it as a film and how it represents that topic in the paranormal. And then we make a decision based on those two things. Now, sometimes it's weak in the paranormal space, but it's a really strong movie. Sometimes it's not so great of a movie, but how they portray the paranormal is awesome. And then it's just up to us to weigh that and just make the decision. And I just thought it was good to kind of reestablish that because Carrie got asked about that too.
Thank you for clarifying. And I have one addition to make to that, that may be only the case for me. I don't know how you think about it, but if I say a movie doesn't get the P for paranormal, it doesn't mean I think you should not see it.
Sure. Okay.
I could imagine certain case where I love a movie that I can't recommend.
Sure.
Or where a movie doesn't really work on a paranormal level, but it's really a great movie, but it can't be on the shelf because it just doesn't do what we need it to do for the paranormal stuff. But so just that's kind of a nitpicky thing, but that it's not to say that movies that don't get the stamp aren't worth looking at. Well, although most of the time we think that's true.
You recommended Tickle to me, so there's not many films you won't recommend, let's be honest.
Don't get me started. You've brought up, no, you don't get to do that.
I've got to go. I've got someone meeting me in my hotel room in a few minutes. Speaking of Tickle, Tony, yeah. We're heading, nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that at all.
I don't like tickling.
I'll show you how much I don't like tickling. Tony, Splash.
Yeah, you know, I here's the thing. I wanna give it a gentle P for paranormal because I recognize the things you talked about. I kind of feel some of the things that you think about it in a negative way, but because of the transformation that Tom Hanks has in that tank. And because of the iconic nature of this maybe being the most incredible mermaid character in a movie, I mean, I don't really recall seeing one that was more beautifully designed or better portrayed by an actor. So I think from those standpoints, it really earns a spot as a silly, goofy comedy. You know, I think it has a reason to be there on the shelf.
I am going to go back to my earlier comment that I think, yes, where this movie ends up going in the second half kind of saves it from itself. Not that it needed saving, maybe even, but in my mind, it kind of did, because I felt a little bit like I was dying on the vine of a dated movie for about halfway through it.
Yeah. There. Yes.
And then it just recovers. So I'm going to recommend it. It's also our first mermaid cryptid film. So unless a better one comes along, I'll knock it right off. I'm getting close myself right to my five.
Look, how could you not love a movie where Daryl Hannah, in one of her early performances, portrays a mermaid who sees a fish tank and fucking waves to a fish? Like, genuinely.
Yeah.
Hello. Wait. It's great.
Yes, I love it. All right, so we both give Splash a fin up.
Hey, look at you. I'm surprised. Based
on Splash, we'll do our top three list tonight. These are the top three interspecies romances in film history. This is when a human mates or falls in love with a non-human. And Tony, you want to begin? Want to dive in those waters first?
Okay. My number three is a movie called Spring, directed by Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. And it's about a young man who is in Italy traveling, and he meets a young woman there and sparks up a romance and finds out she's hiding a secret of some kind. And it's a little dark. It's kind of like a dark indie horror version of Splash in many ways.
I love it. I might watch that tonight.
Spring from 2014. It's excellent. Like that. It's like, you know, that Ethan Hawke movie in Paris with the girl talking for, but there's, except, but it's paranormal.
Except the girl has a flipper.
Yes.
Okay. It sounds awesome. My number three is the Spike Jonze movie Her.
Nice choice.
Right. I saw that in New York City. Loved it. Really loved his performance. Of course, I almost always do. I always do. I can't think of a performance he's given that I haven't loved. And yeah, it's just an incredible take on love and where AI could go and where all this technology could possibly go one day. A real performance, a gritty performance. And yeah, Her. Unbelievable.
Love it.
Blew me away.
My number two is, we're going oldie here with 1942's I Married a Witch, starring Frederick March and the great Veronica Lake, who in many ways is here because there's a Daryl Hannah, Veronica Lake. There's a similar thing going on here. But in this movie, Veronica Lake plays a witch who has been trapped in a tree, and a curse, she gets unleashed on a family, and it's a romantic comedy about a guy who marries a witch, and it's pretty great. Pretty great. Directed by the great Renee Clair. If you like oldies, this is a lot of fun. Similarly goofy, you know, some of it just like, this is too silly, and some of it's just fantastic.
Love it. 1943, I Married a Witch. My number two is so directly related to number one that I probably should have thought of something else. But again, I like this movie just a little bit better than Her, in which a man falls in love with the kind of an operating system, if you will. My second choice, very closely related to that, it's Ex Machina, starring Oscar Isaacs. It was kind of my first real Oscar Isaacs, like, wow, this guy's freaking the real deal moment. You know, I can't remember if Inside Llewyn Davis came before or after Ex Machina. I don't know the answer to that, but in my mind, at least I saw Ex Machina first, even if Inside Llewyn Davis had been out, because I just remember the first time I was like, okay, I've heard this guy's name now three times. I want to see this guy. And he blew me away in Ex Machina. That movie blew me away. Again, technology gone wrong. Can you fall in love with a robot or with artificial intelligence, as it were, and what our future might be like if we keep down this path of loving our computers more than our fellow human beings. So I really loved that movie a lot.
All right. Well, Llewyn Davis came first, according to what I'm seeing here.
Okay. Yeah. So I probably saw Ex Machina first and went back and saw Llewyn Davis.
My number one is maybe technically, I don't know, maybe you'll say that this is technically not accurate enough, But I'm going to go with David Cronenberg's The Fly.
I think that counts.
Well, they fall in love before he turns into a non-human entity.
True, but stay together.
They continue to have a relationship during that process, and he's really not human for much of that movie. So I'm going to say that that's pretty much the granddaddy of, you know, as long as you accept the terms, yep. That to me is the number one with a bullet.
Absolutely. And my number one is an actor who actually kind of stopped acting pretty shortly after this movie. She played the unfortunately named Boof. Susan Ersetti was her name in Teen Wolf. And she was Michael J. Fox's girlfriend. I'm going to say that that counts because that's interspecies romance.
Totally. And, if this does, if fish count.
I think Teen Wolf is on our list for the future, by the way. I think it's going to have some parallels to Splash. I don't know if it'll run as deep, but there's some great moments in Teen Wolf.
I'm glad that we felt the restraint not to include Shape of Water on our lists.
I did not like that movie.
Not a movie for me either.
Really? Okay.
Not for me.
I was like, blah, blah.
Yeah. No, I think there's a reading on that movie wherein she is a crazy, you know, sexual aggressor, and there's a reading on Splash wherein he just might be food.
Yeah. Oh yes. She's luring him.
Yeah.
I freaking love it, and I hope that's what they had in mind. Because now I really love it.
It occurred to me this watch. And my whole deal is like, we have to be together. As long as we're together, we'll be okay, which is this romantic notion. But then I'm like, does that mean like if she swims off 5 feet, he's going to die? Like he's in an interesting predicament. Let's just put it this way.
And how many little boys off the Cape fell into the thing and
just happened to fall? Oh, accidentally. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Think about it. I stayed for 6 days. Follow me in. Wow, that's awesome. Well, I hope that's true. That's so great. Well, Tony, this has been awesome. We will be back next episode with our review of season 4 of Stranger Things, the latest season. And I can't wait, Tony. You ready?
I am. I was lying when I said I'm not excited. I am really excited to talk about it with you, if not to see the season. I really can't wait to have the discussion.
Awesome. All right, buddy. We'll see you soon. Wish me luck on the high seas.
Hey, have fun out there. Be safe, my friend.
Machi balls.
Machi balls.